before. I'm sure you've all gone to classes on the Haggadah, but what I would like to present to you today is a different view of the Haggadah than you've heard before. I would say that in our experience with Judaism, the problem with Judaism really is that most people don't really understand what the real determinants are behind the tradition that we have. And the term tradition has become a watered-down term, meaning something that we do because our forefathers did. But we don't really understand, we don't really have a comprehension of why our forefathers did this and what is involved in what they actually did. I would, just to give an illustration, I would say, like, let us say there was a family who had some hereditary disease, and the doctors prescribed, told this family that you and your children always have to follow a certain regimen if you want to be able to survive. And these people followed this regimen. Then they moved away into an area which, in which they didn't have too much contact with civilization, and as time went on, they kept on following this regimen. But they forgot the reasons for why they were doing these things, and it became like just something that you have to do. Well, mother said we have to do this every day, and they didn't know why. Eventually, they would start attaching different reasons to what they're doing. They wouldn't be the correct ones, but they'd start thinking, well, we have to do this for, maybe this is symbolic of this, or that's symbolic of that. And the real reason for why they were doing these things would be lost. And similarly, in our day, that's what has happened to our people. That we've gone so far away, our people are so far removed from the original source, from the real reasons for what we do in Judaism is. And so, they know something about what they are supposed to do, but they don't really know why. And they start attaching different reasons to it, and the actual reasons have been lost. I would like to today go back to the real reasons for the Haggadah. I'd like to show you the Haggadah in a different light, from the Talmudic standpoint, from its source, the actual formulations, how they took place, and what the concepts are. And just one word of introduction, and that is that it is different. It is definitely different than the way you're used to thinking about the Haggadah. And it's a different approach. And therefore, we'll have to have a little bit of patience in order to be able to see what really it's like. I'd like to start with something from the Haggadah, which perhaps will explain my meaning. Let's take everybody knows the four sons. Everybody's familiar with the four questions that are asked the four sons, four children. And you have on, let's see, which Haggadah do you have? Do you have the ones that have this Haggadah on page 10? If you have this Haggadah, says the wise son. Or the wise son asks, either translation that you have. Now, the Haggadah is like this. Let's take a look. Let's compare the difference between the wise son and the wicked son, or contrary son, evil son, whichever way they translate it. What says the wicked son? Okay. It's interesting to compare the two different formulations, the two different questions that they ask. And let's try to understand what really the difference is. Actually, the night of Pesach really is not just for Pesach, because the night of Pesach is the night in which we discuss the going out of Egypt and the birth of our nation. So the ideas that we take up have universal importance, not just for Pesach, but really they reflect on the whole philosophy of Judaism, because that was the time when the whole philosophy of Judaism was born. Now, it says, the wise son asks, what is the meaning of the rules, laws, and customs which the eternal God has commanded us? Okay? That's his question. What is the meaning of the rules, laws, and customs which the eternal God has commanded us? Actually, I hate to argue with something that's in print, but the translation is really not accurate. It should say, what is the meaning of the rules, laws, and customs which God, our God, has commanded you? That's literally the way the text is. So the wise son asks, what is the meaning of these laws, these customs that God has commanded you? Okay, that's his question. Now let's take a look at the evil son, the wicked son. And he says, what is the meaning of this service to you? So one asks, what is the meaning of the rules, laws, and customs that God has commanded you? And the other one says, what is the meaning of the service to you? Now, on the surface, it would seem to be that it would seem that there really isn't too much difference between the wise son and the wicked son. wherein lies the difference in the question? They're both asking the same question. The wise son says, what's the meaning of these things that were commanded to you? And he abbreviates a little bit. The wicked son says, what is the meaning of the service to you? But for abbreviation, just because you abbreviate something doesn't really mean that no reason to call him wicked. He speaks in shorter terms, more concise, more brief. I mean, why should we say he's wicked and the other one is wise? There must be something within the question itself that is telling us something, is conveying a meaning. The question would seem to be almost the same. And many people ask this question and say, what's the difference? Two questions are almost identical. Yes?
Isn't it equivalent?
Yes. Right? In other words, it says, what is the meaning of the service to? But the wise son also says, what is the meaning of the rules, laws, and customs which the eternal God has commanded you? So he also uses you. That definitely is a difference. But I wouldn't say that because a person forgot to mention God, that because of that he should be considered wicked. Perhaps if he was more thoughtful, he would have said, well, what is the meaning of the service that God gave you? But he didn't. He left out God. I agree with that. That is definitely a difference. There's no question about it. But why should that make the difference? Why should that really be the factor which determines whether he's wicked or whether he's considered wise? You see, when the wicked son says, what is the meaning of this service to you? Now, what is he really saying? He is saying that there is a service here, but this service is to you, which means that the value of this Seder, this whole Seder that you have here, it has value, but what type of value does it have? It has subjective value. It's something that you're doing. It's an important service to you. I respect you, and I respect your religion, and it's wonderful, but the value of this service is to you. In other words, it's subjective. Like today, we say everybody does their own thing, which means your thing has subjective value, my thing has subjective value. So he is saying, in essence, his question posits one thing, that the entire value of the Seder is a subjective one. That's the basic concept of his question. Now, what is really, you see, the wise son doesn't say that the service is value to you. He says, what is the meaning of the laws that God has commanded you? Now, that doesn't mean that it only has value to you. The commandment was to you. It has to be that way. Why must the commandment, if the son is asking, he must say, why did God command you? He can't say commanded us. For a simple reason. Because the commandments are carried down from one generation to the other. So that the commandment reaches one generation and then it has to be transmitted to the next. Naturally, he has to say, God commanded you this? You have knowledge of this? What is the meaning of it? The fact that God commanded you doesn't mean that it only has subjective value. That had to be that way. But if I say that the service is yours, it's your service, that means it's your thing, it's not mine, then you're saying, in essence, that it's subjective. Now, the wicked son, see, it's an interesting thing. When we say wicked, wicked has a certain connotation, evil. It's interesting that the Haggadah, the Baal Haggadah, or the Torah, actually, which really formulated the sentence, it comes directly from the Bible, that the Bible is telling us something about what wickedness is here. Interesting thing, we ordinarily picture wickedness as vicious, distortion, somebody who's terrible, horrible individual. But the Torah over here has an example of wickedness, and it seems to be more or less harmless. Now, what really is the Torah telling us? The Torah is telling us something about evil here, which is very important for us philosophically. Philosophical idea about evil. Yes?
Is it a question of...
Rather than difference, what did he do, actually? You see? Yes.
Well, is it
the principle that lies in this question is that he has already made a prejudgment. He has already made a prejudgment. He doesn't know anything about the area, doesn't know anything about the topic, and yet he comes in right away and he says, you know, this whole service has subjective value. It's fine, you're doing it. But it doesn't have any real objective meaning. It doesn't have any value necessarily to everybody. If you like it, it's fine. You don't like it, it's no good. So the evil, really, according to the Bible, the definition of evil would seem to be a prejudgment. In other words, if a person approaches an area, and he has no knowledge of the area, and he doesn't approach it with an open mind, but rather, immediately he makes his own decision, he decides, he says, well, this has subjective value. Before he knows the area, that is evil. Evil means prejudice. What is prejudice, really? Prejudice is prejudgment. It means you make a judgment before you know the facts. And this, in the eyes of the Torah, is considered evil. Why is this evil? Why is prejudice evil? For a simple reason. Because it's the most harmful thing that a person can do. A person who makes a judgment on matters before he really hears what these things are is harming, really. Who is he actually? The person who is evil in the first instance, is it really evil to who? He's evil to himself. Correct. That's the one that he's harming. Because he's not giving his own self a chance to improve. He's not allowing himself to see the ideas that God gave that might have value for him. But immediately he comes and says, this is your thing. See? This is your tradition. It's not mine. So this really is the worst of all evils. Instead of wickedness being a sinister, an imaginatory figure, evil really is a mistake in the intellect, where a person doesn't think freely and doesn't think logically. Now the Chacham, the wise son, doesn't enter with preconceived notions, but rather he enters it very carefully and cautiously, and he says, if you take a look at his formulation, he says, what is the meaning of the rules, laws, and customs which the eternal God has commanded you, should be you, I say. So what he wants to know is, what are these laws? And the first analysis of how does he analyze the subject? See, the Torah considers him the wise son, so we have to see what the wisdom is here. What is the wisdom, really, in what he says? And if you notice something interesting, let's think about it for a moment. If you would, if somebody would approach the Seder, and you take somebody into a Seder which he's never seen before, immediately, the first question that he'd ask is, why? Why do you do this? Why do you do that? The wise son doesn't really ask why, if you notice. He asks what. The first thing is to find out what are. Actually, the translation, again, is a little bit incorrect. I would translate it like this. What are the laws and customs, the rules, laws, and customs which the eternal God has commanded you? That's the actual translation. I would leave out the meaning. His question is, what are the rules, the laws, and the customs which the eternal God has commanded you? When a person wants to analyze an area, he doesn't ask why. Why, you can only ask after you know what the thing is. If a person is a physicist and wants to understand the universe, he can't ask, well, why? Why did God create the world in the way that there's gravity? I don't know why. That's metaphysics. Let's understand what are the forces that are operating here. In the same way, the wise son, when he approaches the Torah, he doesn't ask why. Why is a question that comes later. The first question is what? Let's see, what do we have in front of us first? And once we know the what, from studying what things are, then we can travel to the why. But immediately just ask why is this and why is that. That is not a wise approach. A wise individual first takes all the information in, and he sees what are the principles, what are the rules, what are the customs. And if you notice, the wise son categorizes. He says, what are the rules? One. Laws? Two. Customs? Three. So that a wise individual knows immediately how to classify things. And that's the first sign of wisdom. A person knows how to classify different things and to define what they are, actually. Then, once you see what they are, then he can start giving philosophy as to why it is so. But to immediately start philosophizing, that is not really a wise approach. And unfortunately, that's what has happened in our generation. Instead of people understanding, as I said before, what really the principles are, what are the Talmudic principles behind the Haggadah, and how is it put together, what they do is they go into different philosophies. Why is the egg on the table? And they give these different reasons. Why do you have the maror? I'll say because of springtime, but different philosophies. Why? But first, they forget one thing, that before you go into why, you have to know what it is. And most of these answers that they give don't even fit in to the real what of the situation. So that's the difference between the Chacham and between the Rasha. The Rasha comes in the evil son comes in with preconceived notions. The wise son doesn't even entertain the why at this point yet. He wants to understand what. What did God tell you? Let's get down to what the laws are. Then once we have the facts and we start analyzing them, we see the principles, then we'll be able to understand the why. That's the difference between the two. Okay. What I'd like to do today is to give you the idea of the Haggadah in terms of the wise son. The what of the Haggadah. That's what I really would like to go into. Yes?
In
spite of the facts.
In spite of the facts, it's right. Prejudice. Isn't
absolutely.
More evil.
I agree with you. Definitely. Right. It shows you really the extent of how ingrained that prejudice is. And even in spite of the facts, you still can't change.
So a person could not be.
No question about it. As a matter of fact, it's interesting. If you'd like to, we can go to the answer that was given to the wicked son. The question is, what do you do with such a person? Really, the Haggadah over here, the Haggadah is trying to tell us how to teach somebody, how to educate somebody, how to improve an individual. We're not interested in harming anybody. Now, the evil son, it says, well, what is it? How do you apply to him? You may therefore tell him plainly, because of what the Eternal did for me when I came forth from Egypt, I do this. For me and not for him. Had he been there, he would not have been redeemed. So what is really the essence of the answer to the evil son? What do you do with a person like that? We have people like that. People who are prejudiced, coming with preconceived notions, and in spite of the facts, as was mentioned, people want to change. The answer that I got is that what you have to do is you have to show him that within his system, he is in contradiction. So you can't, a person like that, you can't reach by showing him the truth, because the truth doesn't have an effect on him. He has his own system. And any fact you give, he's just going to pull it into his system and somehow or other work it in there. What you have to do is you have to show him that within his system he's in contradiction. And that's the answer to the evil son. And the evil son says that this has subjective value to you. So you tell him, just a second, you are respecting me for this subjective value, but you say it has no objective value, right? Well, this very thing that you respect would be something that would be detrimental to you, because based on what you're saying, if you would have been there, you would have been there, assuming that he accepted it wasn't Egypt, it wasn't Exodus, you wouldn't have been redeemed. So why are you being so respectful? Why what's so good about it? Why are you saying it's a nice service for me? It's not a nice service for me. You have to take the person and show him within his framework that he's in contradiction. Some people you can't even do that with. But that's the basic approach of the Torah. When you teach this individual, and the son is not really necessarily a son or a child, it's anybody. It's just an example, showing you how to approach an individual who has these prejudices. The only way you're going to reach him is by showing him within his framework that he's in contradiction. And if you can't show him that, then you'll not be able to reach him. Because they're very adept at mixing, taking anything, making it part of their system, and going on their merry way. That's the way it usually works out.
Right.
Yes. Person. Every time a person asks a question, he doesn't have to mention God. Somebody will say, well, let's see, I'd like to understand the principles of prayer. But he doesn't mention, I'd like to understand the principles of prayer which God has given. You don't have to mention God every time he asks a question. It doesn't mean you're evil if you don't. Maybe it's nicer if you do. I don't know. But that wouldn't really make him evil. What's making him evil is the fact that he says lochem. You see, lochem means for you. It's good for you. For me, not necessarily. It's subjective. That's the point. And that's why it says he excluded himself. He excludes himself by virtue of by making it subjective. If he didn't make it subjective, he wouldn't be excluding himself.
Yours, not mine.
That's right. It's for you. It's very nice for you.
It's
given to the wise son. You take a look. It says, you shall explain to him. You have it on page 10. You shall explain to him all the laws of Passover to the very last detail about the Afikoma. So what does the wise son, what is he interested in knowing, really? What do you explain to him? What do you explain to the wise son? It doesn't say you shall explain to him all the philosophy of Passover, but it says you shall explain to him all the laws of Passover. The laws he's interested in. Because his question is, what are those laws? What are those principles? Just like the physicist studies the laws of nature, he is studying the laws of the Torah. He's interested in what? That's why you have to give him that answer. If you would give him the philosophy, you would be shortchanging him, because you would be bypassing the center of the system, which is the laws and the principles, and that's what you have to teach him. So the wise son really is one who approaches it rationally, and who wants to understand the law. Then you have, while we're on, we might as well finish, you have Tom. That's the simple son. The simple son says, what is this? To him you shall say, with a strong hand, the Eternal God, the Eternal brought us out of Egypt from the house of bondage. Okay? So this is the third son. Now, when the Bible says that there are four sons, this on page 11 in this Haggadah, or in this one, it's probably page 12. I should be able to keep both of them open. And what do you answer him? You say that with a strong hand, the Eternal God has brought us out of Egypt from the house of bondage. Correct? Now, when we say that there are four sons in the Torah, I want you to understand, if the Torah says four sons, it's four and not five and not ten and not three. What I mean is, when the Torah gives you the blueprint, it means it's referring to four possibilities, and there are only four basic possibilities. It's not just arbitrary that it chose the number four. But the Torah chose number four, it's trying to teach you something, that there are four possibilities here, and it breaks it down into four categories. Now, the first category is the wise son. The wise son is the one who isn't prejudiced, but just comes to the Seder with an open mind. That's the wise son. And that's what you notice, it's called wise, it's not called religious. It doesn't say the religious son, what does he ask? Because that's not the important thing here. Before, what we're interested in is wisdom, knowledge, because the Bible maintains that if a person is wise and a person is open-minded, he has the opportunity to understand what the Torah is about, he will naturally follow the Torah. There's no need to be religious about it. It's a natural process that happens to a person when he understands. And if he's just wise and he's just willing to understand, he will naturally follow it. See? And the wicked son is the one who is corrupted in terms of his approach. You can't approach it with an open mind. Now, then, those are two possibilities. One is the height. That's where a person is working freely, has a mind. And the second one is where his mind is already being influenced by certain emotional forces which are preventing him from seeing the picture clearly and fairly. That's the second sign. The third sign is the one, if you notice this question, says, what is this? That's the simple sign. What type of an individual is that? How would you classify that individual? He doesn't know how to formulate. See, the wise son formulates. He sees right away there's three categories here. There's law, there's custom. See? He right away knows exactly how to approach an area scientifically, classified. The simple son doesn't have the mental ability. So the one that doesn't, he just says, what is this? He can't define this question. What is this? He doesn't even know exactly what, something's bothering him, but he doesn't know how to formulate it. See? That's another individual that you have to deal with. You have to deal with the one who is wise, the one who is corrupted emotionally. He might have the brain, he might be a genius, but emotionally he can't see things straight. And then you have the one, so you have the intellect, the one who has a distorted intellect, and the one who doesn't have such a great intellect. We have to deal with every human being, regardless. Everybody doesn't have to be a great scholar. Everybody has to study Torah on their level. There is no such thing as one person studying Torah because he's a great genius and everybody else in the community just remains ignorant. We never had that. In our system, the Jews, every Jew, there was no such thing as an illiterate for the last 3,000 years. See? So the point is, what do you do with a simple son? What do you answer him? So notice the answer. It's very beautiful. It says, to him you shall say, with a strong hand, the eternal God, the eternal brought us out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. In essence, what do you tell? What's the difference between the simple son, the way you teach the simple son, and how you teach the wise son? Yes?
Are you giving him a general?
The way it's formulated, just to elaborate a little bit more, there are two things in the Haggadah. One thing is the events that took place. That's the first thing. And then, from these events, the laws. Now, the law, to be a Talmudic scholar, not everybody is capable, at first sight, just right in the beginning, to be a Talmudic scholar. It takes a lot of training. You can't just walk in there, you know. It's not a free-for-all. You walk in and you're right away, you know, you're in the Gemara. So, in order, you have to start with the basics. So the first thing you tell them is the events that took place, the simple story. And even the greatest scholar has to sit down at the Seder and has to explain to any person, no matter who he might be, what the plain, simple event is. And that's the third son. The third son is the one that doesn't have this intellectual ability, but he has to understand on his level. So you explain it to him more simply. As a matter of fact, Maimonides says, Maimonides mentioned, he says, you must explain to him, you must try to show him. You must try to show him. Demonstrate. Like audiovisual aids. That's why the Haggadah is the only book that we have that when you go, the earliest Haggadah is you always see pictures in the Haggadah. See, we have pictures in this Haggadah. The reason why I have pictures in the Haggadah is because that's for the third son. In order to show, demonstrate, audiovisual aids, show them how. But then as he progresses, he leaves the audiovisual aids and he goes up to a higher level. He can go into the intellectual sphere. He doesn't have to have those aids anymore. That's the time. The last son, the fourth, really there's only three possibilities here. There's a person who has a good intellect, a distorted intellect, and a weak intellect. The fourth son is really is not a qualitatively differentiated individual. It's the same as the third, but he's a little bit weaker. It's She'eni Yodei Lishaol, the son who does not even know how to ask a question. You must begin for him. As it is written, you shall tell your child on that day. So the fourth son is the one who doesn't know how to ask. What type of a person is that, actually? What type? It's a different categorization here. Is he simple? So when you teach somebody, if you want to teach somebody, so you're really confronted with these four types. Either a wise individual who has a clear mind, a prejudiced individual, an individual who is not so intellectual, and the fourth type of person you're confronted with is an unmotivated, or perhaps sometimes an introverted individual. So what is the law? What do I have to do with the unmotivated person? How do I approach him? The answer is, do I have to forget about him? He's unmotivated. He's introverted. It's his problem. And why do I have to be concerned with it? What is the actual practice that the Torah tells us to do in that situation?
Okay.
That's right. You have to motivate him. You are obligated to make him ask. You, Apsachlo, you must be the one that opened it up for him. You have to learn how to get him interest, to arouse his interest. So really, a father, and not necessarily a father, a father here represents the teacher. Could be the father's the teacher, could be the sometimes many stories that I know of, the son is the teacher, the father's the student. The roles are just given here as and models, but they don't really always fit the case. If you have a son that's very brilliant, he explains to his father. So that really what the Haggadah tells us with these four sons is four possibilities. Four possibilities are really only those are the basic four possibilities of, that you have when you're teaching an individual. Intellectual, distorted intellect, lack of intellectuality, and lack of motivation. Those are the four sons. And in each case, the Torah tells you exactly how to handle every situation. Okay. We're interested in right now. So we would like to understand the Haggadah as the wise son, or attempt to understand the Haggadah as the wise son sees the Haggadah. That's really the purpose of this meeting here. Okay. Now, what I will is, I'll try, let me start with the very beginning. And we'll go through as much as we can, step by step. Okay, but through the Talmudic approach, rather than the philosophical approach. Talmudic approach to the principles that are involved in the Seder. All right, now, if you take a look, and this I got is on page 4. And in this Haggadah, the first step in Haggadah, I'm interested in one word here. First step in Haggadah is Kaddish. That's number one. Kaddish means recite the Kiddush. That's the first step in Haggadah. Okay, for most people, they read it. Kaddish, recite the Kiddush. What does it mean? Well, it's nice to say Kiddush, very nice thing. Say Kiddush, a cup of wine, drink a little wine. Very nice, pleasant. It's a good tradition. But what is really the meaning of Kiddush? Say. The interesting thing is that the Kiddush that's recited on the night of Passover is different than any other Kiddush that you make throughout the year. How is it different? Because every Kiddush that you make throughout the year, you're permitted to recite the Kiddush up to an hour and a quarter before the time, like Shabbos. I can make Shabbos early. I'm sure that you've seen people that go to shul on Shabbos before nightfall. You can recite the Kiddush at an earlier time. This Kiddush you cannot recite until nightfall. Why can't you recite this Kiddush until nightfall? Because the Kiddush is the first of the four cups of wine. The four cups of wine, as we'll learn later, must be recited only at nighttime. It must be after sundown. Before sundown, it's worthless. We'll see as we go into that a little later why that is. But since that is the case, this Kiddush must be said after sundown, because the cup of Kiddush is the first cup of the Seder. Now let's understand the four cups. Really, what are the four cups? We all know the four cups. You have to have four cups of wine. How does this fit into the framework? What does the Talmud have to say about what is the concept behind the halachic concept behind the four cups? What actually is it, these four cups? What's the purpose of them?
Symbolic.
It is, you see, where does it say, let me go a little further. You're right, it is symbolic. And I know that we're familiar with the concept of symbolism, but in our Torah, it doesn't say anywhere in the Torah, as one of the commandments, one of the 613 commandments, it doesn't say anywhere is be symbolic or employ symbolism. It just says, the Torah just says, follow the 613 mitzvahs. That's all God asks us to do. So that if we have something which is symbolic, why should I do something that's symbolic? I mean, I could figure out, we could sit here today, get together, and we could work out so many different symbolisms that might be beautiful, maybe even more beautiful than four cups. What obligates me to do this? Why must I, where does the Torah tell me to drink the four cups of wine? How do I know I'm supposed to do this? The law. Like the Chacham asks, where is the law? How do the four cups come from the law that God gave us? You see? Okay. Everybody's familiar with Manash Tanach? Page 8 in this Haggadah, this one. The last one of the four questions. Everybody's familiar with the last question. Questions on all other nights we eat sitting up or reclining. And on this night, we eat reclining. Okay? Again, what is the concept of reclining? And where does the Torah say to recline?
The Lord.
Sign of being free. But where does it say in the Torah that I have to employ that sign?
Symbolism.
But where does it say in the Torah that you have to be symbolic? The question is, when I'm trying to show that we don't know, we do these things, we don't know what the source is, the halachic source from the Torah. And that's what we're trying to really accomplish here. The answer is like this. The answer is that the Torah says there's one mitzvah in the Torah that the whole Seder is based upon. And that mitzvah is the Gadatol of Hincha. That you must teach your child on this night all about the Exodus. The night of the 15th, the night that the Jews prepared to leave on the following morning. That night is a night that was for generations. From that time on, on will always exist as a night in which the people, the nation as a whole, transmit from one generation to the next what happened in Egypt on that night. Now, the mitzvah is the gadat halacha. You must teach your child on that night what happened. Now, teaching involves two things according to the way the mitzvah was formulated, and according to the way it was formulated at Sinai, passed down through the Talmud. The Talmud understood teaching to mean not just telling, but another aspect. What is the other aspect? Telling and
showing.
Okay, great. Telling and showing. Exactly. Right. The concept of reclining comes under what? Demonstrate. It isn't enough to just tell, but you have to demonstrate. Reclining is the demonstration, and you have another demonstration, that is the four cups of wine. The cups of wine, you're right. It is symbolic of freedom. But why? Why do I have to be symbolic at night? Where is the mitzvah? Where did the Torah tell me to be symbolic? The answer is, the Torah says you must tell your child on that night. And the rabbis understand that this is the oral law. When it explains the written law, it doesn't say just tell. It says tell and show. Show and tell, right. That's why I mentioned before. That's why there are pictures in the Haggadah. Because it's not just tell, it's show. Exactly. Now, it's interesting, but why is it that the Torah in this instance insisted on visual demonstration? You know, like for instance, if I give a class in the yeshiva, so that's a commandment. You're supposed to teach Torah. Everybody's supposed to teach Torah, not just me, everybody. But over there, there's no law of demonstration. I don't have to go onto a blackboard and demonstrate. If I have a difficult point, I'll use a blackboard. But there's no law that says I must do it. Over here, the Torah says, you must show. Why do you think this is so? Let's go into the why over here. Since we have the what, now we'll go into the why. Maybe we'll be able to really understand what it is.
The whole level
of whining and dining is a sign of freedom. A person who's a slave can't do that. Correct. But the reason why, that's exactly the reason. Why it is that the Torah says that over here, when it says tell your child, not enough to tell. You have to demonstrate. Sure. Why demonstrate? Because you're dealing with all that. Like Mr. Kaplan said, a picture's worth a thousand words. When you see something, when a child sees something, especially a child, I don't know if it's hard to remember your child, but I know in my childhood I remember these certain pictures and images that were in my mind, they just can't remove them. They're just there. And that's why the Torah employed this way, because this really is the best way. Actually, in modern education also, within the last 50 years, they've started this concept of audiovisual. But the only thing, there is a difference between their approach and ours. Their approach, we would disagree with some things that they do, because in our approach, we start off with the audiovisual and end up in the abstract. In their approach, many times, the audiovisual could be a distraction, too. You have to know where to use the audiovisual. When a child needs it, it's the most important thing. But then the idea is to wean them away from the physical images to the intellectual formulation, which is the highest. But that's the reason. Okay, the four cups is really the kiddush. That's the first of the four cups. And that's why it must be done at nighttime, because all the mitzvahs that are done on Pesach must be only at night. Why kiddush must be at nighttime on Pesach? Because it's the first of the four cups. But we can ask a little further, beyond that point. The question that we should ask now is, we know that Kiddush is the first of the four cups, right? But what question should we ask now? What question? At nighttime, the answer is, it's the four cups. What is the four cups? It's the mitzvah of showing, telling. And then, the Kiddush being the first of the four cups can only be done during that time. During that time when the Jews actually were involved in going out of Egypt. Therefore, it must be done at night. Right. But now there's one question we have to come to. What is the question? Kiddush is concerned. There's one question we have to ask. Why should Kiddush really be the first of the four cups? Let me just, I see what the problem is. See, the problem is that, we don't have a definition of Kiddush.
That's the question.
Kiddush, really. That's the question. Is Kiddush thanks to God? Is Kiddush praising God? I mean, everything is praise to God. I mean, whenever you have a blessing, it always has a praise in there. But the question is, what's the essence of the blessing? Is it really a praise? Is it a thanks? What is Kiddush? And we say Kiddush all the time. We all know of Kiddush, but very few people know what it is exactly. What is Kiddush?
Acknowledging.
Very good, isn't it? Very good. Definition of Kiddush is acknowledging or enunciating the fact that this day, what does Kiddush mean? Kiddush comes from the word holy. Now the word holy in Christianity, our Christian brethren have taken this word holy and have given a certain type of a feeling, like a holiness, you know, floating around the atmosphere. But we don't have such a concept in Judaism. The word Kodesh, really, the term Kodesh, comes from what? What does the word Kodesh come from? Kodesh means separated. And you have many times in the Bible, The word Kaddish doesn't mean holy, it's separated. Now, designated has a specific designation. That's what the word. That's all the word holiness means. It's not a mystical thing. It means distinction, right? Separation, distinction, designation, any one of those terms. Now, in what way, when we make Kiddush on Shabbos, what are we saying? What is the enunciation there?
It's different than
the other days.
That's right.
The point of Sabbath is that the day is different. The essence of any holiday is that the day is different. How is the day different? How is the day different? Primarily, how is the day different? It's different insofar as a person must refrain from doing certain activities during that day. So that's the basic difference. Now, when we start off with Kiddush, Kiddush means the moment you come to the Seder, what's the first thing you do? You think of all different things. It's nice to say to this for children, you know, but the first thing has to be, the first logical step is to do what? What is our God to tell us?
This day
is different. Before you get started, what are you doing here? Yeah. The question is, you have to understand, what is the whole Seder? The whole Seder is beginning, but what is the prime mover? What is the first idea that you have in regard to the Seder? The first thing you have is that this night is different. It's different. How is it different? It's different because you have to refrain. It's a holiday. You have to refrain from certain activities. Holidays weren't made for the same purposes that we use the rest of the week for. It has different designation, different purpose. Okay, it's made the rest of the week. We spend our time perfecting ourselves in other ways. We have to spend time in materialism. We need certain things to live with, different things. Sabbath, and the holidays is a different designation. It's for the designation of the soul, not the body. Designation for designated for study, for knowledge, for Torah, not to be involved in mundane things. That's the basic designation of the holidays. So that the first step that you must have in the Haggadah is to enunciate this fact that tonight, the night of the 15th of Nisan, is a different night altogether. That's the first step. Now, why is that enunciation really? Now, why is that enunciation part of the Haggadah, part of the telling? Because it's the first cup, it means it's part of the mitzvah of telling. Why is this part of the telling? The answer is, when you tell, you have to tell the story from the beginning. You can't just come in and just tell a story. You have to start from scratch. What is the first thing? The first thing you must say is that this night is different than any other night. It's different because it is a night which is separated. It's a Yom Tov. It's a holiday. Okay. That's why you have the first cup there. Now, let's go to the Manishtana. And we'll see, the Manishtana is an interesting thing. Four questions. Interestingly enough, I'd like to give you the Maimonidean view of the four questions. The Maimonidean view of the four questions is totally different than any concept we've ever heard about the four questions. Because according to Maimonides, there are no four questions. And I'll show you what exactly. I know it sounds revolutionary, it sounds non-traditional, you know, it's terrible almost. But Maimonides maintains, if you look carefully into the way Maimonides formulates his Haggadah, he maintains there are no four questions. But before we make that decision, we'll see other rabbis hold that there are four questions. It is an argument among the Talmudic scholars. And I'm not going to be in favor of Maimonides' view or the other view. I'd like to understand both views and just see what they say. I'll leave the decision to you. Let's take a look at page 8, and we'll go through the four questions. I'd like to see exactly if you could hit upon what the essence of these four questions are. Because it's very interesting. The first question is, and I'll give my own translation, because these translations aren't necessarily accurate anyway. The first question is that on all other nights, we eat leavened bread, essentially. We can eat regular bread, but tonight it's only matzah, okay? Second question is that on all other nights, we eat all types of vegetables. Tonight, we eat bitter herbs. We usually don't eat just plain bitter herbs. You either mix it into something, but just to take bitter herbs and just eat it straight is not a usual practice. So this is the second point. Okay? Now there was another question in the time when the Holy Temple existed. Does anybody know what it is? The sacrifice. That's right. Before the exile, there was actually another question. The other question was, how come on all other nights we don't have any sacrifice and tonight we have the Paschal Lamb? So that's not here anymore because we don't have that anymore. But there was actually five questions. Then the third one is also, I'll explain it to you as a little later, but I don't want you to concentrate on that one too much because the meaning isn't on the surface. The third one is, how come we dip twice? We take, in the beginning, you take the karpas,
After the kiddush, you take the karpas, you take a piece of potato or vegetable, you dip it in salt water. Everybody is familiar with that. And then later, when you eat, you take the matzah, and you take the morah, and you dip it in the charosis, right? So we dip twice on that night, right? There's one question, you know, there's a question that almost nobody has ever answered. The question is, they say, if you're going to maintain, these are four questions, so there's a child supposed to be asking these questions, right? Now, how does he know that you dip twice? He hasn't seen that part of the Seder yet. He saw you take the potato and dip it in salt water, but he never saw you take the morah and dip it in the charosis. That comes later. How does he know he asked the question? So they say he remembers from last year, but that's not really a good answer. Like my son's going to yeshiva. So in a way, it really he's preparing the manashtana. It's not supposed to be prepared. It's supposed to be spontaneous motivation. And yet the kids come home from the yeshiva, you know, and they parallel it beautifully, and the parents are so happy, it's wonderful. But you're missing the whole point. The point is it's supposed to motivate him to really see something different. And it's supposed to be his own questions, not repetition. That's something which, on the contrary, many times stifles the mind and stifles the intellect. You don't want to do that to a child. But unfortunately, not all our traditions are executed properly where they should be. So the third question is why you dip twice. And the fourth question we took already. The fourth question was the reclining. Why do we recline on that night? Now let's limit ourselves to the first two. First two is matzah is one, and then morah. And I said, before the Holy Temple was destroyed, 2,000 years ago, they would have another question. That was the Paschal Lamb. Let's deal with those three questions. What does that show? What do you think those, what do those questions really have? What is the essence of those questions? Remember, Matzah, Maror, and Paschal Lamb. What are those questions really revolve themselves around?
Freedom.
Let me just share one thing. Freedom and captivity, remember, that's already the why. But let's try to understand more of the what. Before you get to the freedom, yes? That definitely is one aspect. That it's a continuation of the Kiddush. That's number one, because it's showing you the separation. You're right about that. But the separation through what? Through what? What is matzah, morah, and paschal lamb? What are the commandments? You take a look at the Torah, you see, before they went out of Egypt, and then later when the Torah tells you for the succeeding generations how to do it, it says you must have the paschal lamb, and you must have the matzah, and you must have the morah, right? So those three things were the commandments, the mitzvos halayla, the commandments of the night. So actually, the four questions is really a concise Shulchan Aruch. That's what it is. It tells you briefly what the mitzvos, what the commandments of the night are. Take a look. First commandment of the night is matzah. Next one you have to eat morah. Now let's get to question three. Paschal lamb, we don't have today. Question three. What is question three? Question three is, why do you dip twice? Now, what's the reason for the dipping? The reason for the dipping is, the real reason why you're supposed to dip is, and the reason why you dip before the manashtana is, because you're supposed to do something unusual so that the child will ask. And when you take a piece of potato and you sit down and you dip it in salt water, they say, what is this? Well, we never eat this way. So the reason for the dipping is to arouse the curiosity of the child. That's the real reason. So what mitzvah is that to arouse? Which mitzvah does that come under to arouse the curiosity? Teaching. That's right. You got to learn. Teach your child on that night. That is the mitzvah. So you see, that's 1, 2, 3. Matzah is a mitzvah. Moror, teach, and the fourth one is what? What is the fourth one? Where it says reclining. That's also teaching. So really, 3 and 4 are two forms of one mitzvah. It's the actual verbal teaching to arouse him so that he asks questions and you answer him. And then to demonstrate also. So really the manashtana, which is everybody is familiar with, but if you look at it from the standpoint of the Talmudic law, what is the manashtana? It really is the commandments of the night. That's what it is. It's in a nutshell, briefly formulated, what are the commandments of the night? Commandments of the night are matzah, morah, and sipur. Those are the three commandments. There are no more commandments that night. That's it. It doesn't have to enunciate every form. You're right.
Wine is
the same thing as reclining. That's the demonstration part. In other words, the demonstration, you have to demonstrate freedom and you have to speak about freedom. So the first one is to tell. And the second one is to show, to demonstrate. And you demonstrate in two ways, through the wine and through the reclining. Through both those ways. So really, the fourth question includes all the demonstrations, even though it doesn't mention the wine. Probably the reason why it doesn't mention the wine is because the wine is something which it didn't come yet. You just had the Kiddush. You just had the Kiddush, and you didn't have the four cups yet. Four cups are much, much later. Same thing. There's no question that the idea of one fits into the same thing as the as reclining, because the reclining of the one is just demonstration. You see? So actually, the four questions are really the three commandments. There's matzah, there's morah, and there's demonstration, and telling and demonstrating. That's what the Ma'arish Tana is. That's why Maimonides says that really they aren't questions at all. But the law is that when a person sits down to the Seder on the eve of Passover, he has to enunciate. Let's enunciate these four mitzvos. Actually, three mitzvos, four forms. Why does he have to enunciate these four forms? Because, as you mentioned before, it's a continuation of the Kiddush. See, Kiddush is, you mention that the day is different. Now, if you're going to begin the Seder, you have to mention the day is different, right? So when you mention the day is different, how is the day different? The day is different because it's a holiday. That's Kiddush. You enunciate today is separated from the rest of the week because it's a holiday. We have to refrain from certain activities and involve ourselves in other activities. Then you say, but one second, if it's different because it's a holiday, there are a lot of holidays. So maybe it's Sukkot, maybe it's Shavuos, maybe it's Shabbos. You see? So then the Ma'arish Tana says, no. How is this night different from all other nights? Means how is it different from Pesach, from the Sukkot, from Shavuos, from Shabbos? How is it different from Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur? What's the answer? The answer is these different mitzvahs. The night of Passover, if you want to have a definition of Passover, if somebody asks you, what is Passover? What is the halachic, Talmudic definition of Passover? What is the answer? The answer is, it's a holiday which has certain mitzvahs. These are the mitzvahs. That's the definition. So actually, the mitzvah was in existence, and also the mitzvah of Haggadah. See, that's basically what it is. Okay, any questions? Mentioned that his grandfather, who was, in his day, was the greatest scholar alive in his time, and what he would do is every Pesach he would do something different for the children. He'd wear something unusual or anything. Because Maimonides mentions that you should do different things. The Rambam says that you should do different things on that night, so that the children should ask. And what I try to do is, and as a matter of fact, I give it quite a bit of thought before Yom Kippur, to try to work out different things that will arouse his interest, so that he'll be able to ask about the Seder and about Pesach, and I'll be able to answer his questions. Because this is really the most important thing. When a child really is interested, when it's his question that he's asking, that's when he gains. But if he's just parroting over a question, fine, okay, I would assume the reason why they started to do this is because in many homes, when people come to the Seder, it's the parents that are at fault, but people come to the Seder, so they just say, well, let's see, have to get to the eating in about an hour and a half, and then we have to, a lot of our gutters are there, so we might as well get started, and just, and forget about everybody. Forget about the children. So probably the reason why the rabbi, the cheders and the yeshivas, why they did this was, you know, the kid should come, he has to have something there, so let him say the Ma'arish Tana. But that really isn't the right way to do it. The right way to do it is to sit down and ponder and work out different means of arousing his questions. And that's really what you want to do. You want to arouse his interest. And when he's interested, he asks a question. One question from a child that's interested is worth 100 questions that he's been taught. Just repeat over, and he's not really interested in the answer. And that's why what you mentioned is correct. As a matter of fact, it's brought down in the Shulchan Aruch, in the actual law, the formulation of the law, that one should not conduct a Seder in a language that people don't understand. Mm-hmm. I myself, in the Seder that I conducted the Yeshiva, we conduct it in English, because there are women there that don't understand Hebrew, and we say the entire Seder in English. Now, the reason is because the Shulchan Aruch mentioned, the whole purpose of the Seder is to transmit ideas, to gain ideas, gain knowledge. And we gain knowledge through conversing with one another. That's the way we gain the knowledge. Now, if I'm going to speak in Hebrew and no one knows what I'm talking about, it's worthless. Now, I agree, perhaps it would be nice if everybody could speak Hebrew. And I agree, it would be wonderful. But this is not the time, at this point, where you're interested in conveying an important message, to forfeit the message for the language. You want to work on Hebrew, work on it at a different time. But the main thing is, The main conformity that I would like to see among Jews is the conformity of ideas, that we should really all share the same ideas together. This would be a great thing, to share the knowledge we've got together. That would be more important than just saying, having the same language when we don't really understand what we're doing.
Should the Amir be
saying? Essentially, if you look at the... We never had a Haggadah, if you go back to the Mishnah. But of course, then again, you might say we did have a Haggadah. It wasn't formulated in a book, because it was all the oral law. But if you study the Mishnah, In the end of the tractate of Pesachim that deals with this area, you have the whole Haggadah. But of course you have to know, you have every principle there and exactly what you're supposed to do and what you're supposed to say. But it wasn't formulated in the book until much later. See? But this, the Haggadah dates back to Moses. That was the first Haggadah, sure. The Moses and the Aroas. The Mishnah is a straight carried down from Moses. And the Haggadah is as old as the Torah. Because yes, could be. It really could be. I don't know exactly.
The four cups, I don't know what
symbolizes freedom is actually wine, and the drinking of wine per se symbolizes the freedom. But the four cups is because there are four sentences in the Torah that are mentioned insofar as redemption is concerned. So when somebody asks you as to why there are four cups, the reason is it's representative of the four terms of redemption that are mentioned in the Torah. That's the reason for it. But insofar as the reclining is concerned, it doesn't really matter if it's what exactly it is, whether it's Roman or whether it doesn't matter. As a matter of fact, some say that today you shouldn't recline. And whether they say that since it's not the custom to recline today, so it wouldn't be good. In other words, the expression of freedom was an expression of freedom in terms of how the society, how you view freedom today. Now, in Roman times, they viewed that way, they do it that way. In each society, the way it was done. And that's why some say that today the whole reclining isn't really a necessity. Others argue, they say that once the rabbis formulated it this way, you should do it this way, because otherwise you're not doing anything. And this way, if you recline, and then people see that you're doing something, say, why are you reclining? Well, it was symbolic of freedom, and you get onto the topic, you get onto the discussion. So we do recline, but there are those that argue, and they say that today wouldn't be valid. That's a very good point.
Another question.
View of the entire Haggadah. Of course, when I take a look at Haggadah, it's so confusing. You look through pages and pages, and you don't really know what's happening and why you do this at this time and that at another time. So let me just break down briefly the whole Haggadah for you. And at least you'll have an understanding as to what the categories are here. And you'll know where everything fits in. All right? Now, right? So up to there, we're fine. We know what that is. Now, you see what it says? And this one says the answer. Right? From Avodah Mayinu. In this Haggadah, it's page 12. Tehillim. What page is it yours, Bobby? Okay. Until 14. From page 12 or page 14.
Until?
Three parts. We'll see that these could be further subdivided, but let me just give you the three basic parts. So when you walk away from here, at least you feel you know about what the Haggadah is, the basic breakdown of the Haggadah, which I think is very important. Now, The difference between these three parts are as follows. Let me just give you the classification. The first part, let's take a look at the first part, the Avodah Mayinu. Now, that we were slaves for Pharaoh in Egypt. But take a look a little further. It says, Vafilu kulonu chachamim. Therefore, even though we were all wise, all men of understanding, and even if we were all old and well learned in the Torah, it would still be our duty to tell the story of the departure from Egypt. So that tells you that even if you're wise, you have to tell about the departure, right? Take a look. Then you go through the, after that you have a little story there. Then you have the four sons, right? And then, if you take a look on, in this I got a page 11, line 5. And in this I got a Yochel Meresh Chodesh. Where is that?
It's page 13.
Page 13, which line?
Little paragraph.
Okay. The ceremony should be performed on the first day of Nisan. The Torah therefore tells us on that day, on Passover, saying on that day, one might suppose that the Seder should be conducted during the daytime. No, inasmuch the Torah is because of all this, so you know it's nighttime. What is that telling you, really? All these things are telling you one thing. Deal with one thing. How to perform the mitzvah of Sipur, of Haggadah. Haggadah means to tell. All this whole chapter of Haggadah really is like a Shulchan Aruch. It tells you how to do it. The four sons is an instance. It tells you how to answer your son. You want to do the mitzvah of Haggadah? It's very nice to want to do the mitzvah, but we have to have some knowledge as to what the best way to approach it is. So really, the first section of the Haggadah is the section that tells you who is obligated to say the Haggadah, even if we're all wise, we have to do it, who must say it, how to say it, and when to say it. You see? When it must be at nighttime. Who? Everybody. And how? It depends on the one who you're talking to. One son you have to talk to one way, another son you have to speak to another way. Mm-hmm. So the whole Haggadah, up to that point, really, essentially is the halachos, the how of the Seder. Because there's a certain formula that we have in the Haggadah. You can't just, a person might want to convey information, you might make a mistake if he doesn't really think into what he's doing properly. So it gives you advice on how you perform the law. That's the first part of Agada. Now, Tzei Lamad is an interesting thing. Tzei Lamad, which is on page 12 or page 14, depending on the Agada you have, Tzei Lamad is perhaps the most confusing part of the Agada for most of us. We don't really know what's going on here. And that goes, keeps on going through the 10 plagues, and it keeps on going even through Dayenu, until you come to the point on the Seder where you say, Pesach, Matzah, and Morah. Pesach we ate for this reason, and Matzah, you pick up the Matzah, and the Morah, everybody's familiar with that. Now, from the first part to that part is the confusing part, and I'd like to explain it to you, show you how it works, and what exactly it is, and what the concept behind it is, so that you'll know what this is all about. You see, it's a little bit difficult, but I think we can get it across. You see? Page 12 in this Agada, page 14 in the other Agada. Come and learn what Laban the Syrian tried to do to our father Jacob. While Pharaoh decreed only against the males, Laban desired to uproot all. For so it is written, a Syrian sought to destroy my father, and he went down to Egypt and dwelled there, a handful, few in number. There he became a nation, great, mighty, and numerous. Okay? Now take a look at the next few words. He went down to Egypt. Why did he go there? Why did he go down to Egypt? He was compelled by God's decree. He dwelled there. This means that Jacob, our father, did not go down to Egypt, etc. Next one, few in number, as it is said. Your forefathers went down to Egypt, and there became a nation. What is going on here? You notice the quotation marks on each one. He went down to Egypt, quotes, right? He dwelled there, quotes. What is happening here? Does anyone see what is taking place? What is taking place is as follows. Take a look at the sentence. You have a sentence here. The sentence is, Assyrian sought to destroy my father, and he went down to Egypt and dwelled there a handful, few in number. Right? So you have like this. You have, he went down to Egypt. Now it's going back to explain every part of that sentence. He went down to Egypt. Why did he go there? He dwelled there. What does that mean? Few in number. What does that mean? And there became a nation. What are its annotations? What happens here is you're taking a sentence out of the Torah, and then you're taking parts in order, part of each sentence, and you're explaining it. You have the whole sentence from the Torah, you take a part of it, a part of the sentence, and you explain it. Next part, explain that. Next part, explain that. And this goes on straight through until it finishes an entire chapter in the Torah. You see? Even... Grandma, yes?
Did Jacob go to Egypt to escape the Syrians? Or
no.
Did he go there to get food? Or
he went there to get food.
To get food.
That's right.
Well, what does it mean when Assyrian sought to destroy my father and he went down to Egypt and dwelled there?
I know it is confusing. Let me explain that to you. That's a confusing part. Actually, the first part has nothing to do with the second part. It has nothing to do with it. That's absolutely right. You're 100% right. The man is right. And not only is it confusing to you, but I can tell you that a number of my students don't understand this either. What it means is as follows.
I hope by now they do.
I hope so. When it says Assyria went down to Egypt, Assyria sent my father, and he went down to Egypt, right?
My father.
Assyria, different incidents. The reason, actually, it shouldn't have mentioned the part about Assyrian sought to destroy my father. That's out of context.
That
it doesn't belong there. That was Laban. That was way before.
Sure.
That didn't happen at that time. So actually, the Bible should have started this way. My father went down to Egypt and dwelled there, a handful few in numbers. Why did it mention the fact about the Syrian? That was an outside incident. The reason for that is as follows. Because what the Torah is trying to tell us is that we only know that we were almost destroyed in Egypt. That we know. Like, in the time of Hitler, Yimach Shimon, and the Nazis, we know that there were out people to destroy us. But Laban, nobody thinks of Laban as a person who really was so wicked that he wanted to destroy us. You really have to look through in the Torah, and you'll see that he really was wicked. But actually, he's not famous as a wicked person. So the concept that the Bible is telling us is that we're thankful to God about the overt attempts at destruction that we were saved from. But there are also covert attempts at destruction that took place that we're unaware of, and we have to be thankful for those also. That's why it adds that as well. See, but and that was added to ramify the concept of the going out of Egypt. Don't just think it's Egypt. Egypt was terrible, and then there are many terrible situations. But there are so many situations that we don't see that were really just as bad, if not worse.
It makes Laban worse.
It says Laban is worse. Because this Pharaoh only wanted to destroy the males. But Laban wanted to destroy everybody. And you don't even think of Laban as such a terrible person. So the answer is that we're not aware of a lot of times how close we come to destruction and we're saved by God's hand. That's the concept. But that's why that was put in. But essentially, that's not part of the story of Egypt. So at any rate, what happens is that when it says Assyrian sought to destroy my father, and then you have annotations, this goes straight through, all the way through, till the matzah and morah that I told you before. It's constantly that biblical paragraph and then annotations. Biblical passage, phrase, annotations. Why is this done? This is considered the main part of the Haggadah. As a matter of fact, it was a time about a thousand years ago when there was a different custom. You know, some people would do this. They would take out the Bible and they'd read straight through the Bible about the whole Exodus. You have the most beautiful explanation from the Bible itself. And yet we read this. It would seem like absurd. Why read this little passage with annotations, and the annotations go back to the story? Just take out the Bible and read it straight from the Bible, the whole story. Beautiful story there. The rabbis at that time said that anyone that does that is a sign. He's completely misled, because that's not the proper way to do it. Why is that not the proper way to do it? One reason is as follows. You see, there are, in our religion, there is nothing in our religion that we have that is unintellectual. Everything that we do in the religion is an intellectual performance and has concepts and ideas behind it. That's what the oral law is. Without the oral law, we wouldn't know anything. Without the oral law, we wouldn't know what it means to tell your son. We can tell him a sentence and that's it. Wouldn't know about demonstrating, wouldn't know how to tell, when to tell. The oral law tells us the formula for the mitzvah. Now, one of the mitzvahs, the main mitzvah of telling of the Haggadah, is not just the mitzvah of telling the story. That's the first part. We told the story, Avadim Hayinu, and then we go into the halachos, right. But now, there's another thing. We have to learn the story. And what does learn the story mean? We have to take out the Bible and learn it, because nothing goes without learning. Without knowledge, nothing has any value. So what does learning mean? Learning doesn't just mean reading a passage from the Torah. That's not good enough. If you read a passage from the Torah and you don't annotate and you don't think into it, then it has no value. So what is the central part of Haggadah? And this is the central part of Haggadah. The central part of Haggadah is take this passage from the Torah, take every phrase, think into it, annotate, understand it. How do we understand it? With the oral law. Because when you have each of these annotations is from the oral law. The Bible says this, and now the oral law explains it. Bible says it, and the oral law explains it. And you're supposed to learn it, understand it, understand the Bible, understand the written law, and understand the oral law. The central part of Haggadah, this is the main part. The main part is learning. Sit down and learn. You told the story very nice, but you can't just get away with telling a nice story and walk away and feel that you actually accomplished something. If you didn't sit down and study and learn and think into it, then you don't really understand what went on, what the mitzvah is. So one part, the first part of Haggadah is to tell the son, simple son, you tell him a simple story, you can't go any further. But then you have to learn. And this is the main part of Haggadah. Tzei ulamad. You see what it says, come and learn? In the beginning of the chapter it says, come and learn what Laban the Syrian tried to do. Right in the beginning on page 12. On this Haggadah, page 14 in the other Haggadah. Does it say come and learn then?
It says inquire.
Inquire. The real translation, this is a better translation. Come and learn. Tzei ulamad. Come and learn. This is the importance of learning. So from this part of the Haggadah, till the mitzvos is the learning part of the Haggadah. The Seder would be incomplete. It would not be Jewish if it didn't have learning in it. Learning and Judaism are tied hand in hand. Without learning, there's no Judaism. So, 21, how is it in your Haggadah? Of Sipor. The third aspect of Sipor. This third aspect is, let's take a look at this. I think this is the part of the Seder that everybody is probably most familiar with, because it's simple and it's clear. Rabban Gamliel used to say, whoever does not explain the following three symbols at the Seder on Passover has not fulfilled his duty. And these are the Passover offering, the matzah, and the bitter herbs. Now what does this have to do with Haggadah? Haggadah means tell. But again we said that tell is not done so simply in our religion. Telling is an involved process. First, it's how to tell, who to tell, learn it, and now there's a third aspect of this telling procedure. What is the third aspect of this telling procedure? To teach through what?
Through the
In other words, if you don't show Exactly. Everything you've learned is wonderful. But if you don't show me the relationship between what you've learned and the mitzvahs that we're doing, again, you didn't fulfill your obligation. If you don't tie in your learning and your knowledge to what you're doing, to the practical experience of doing the mitzvah, then again, you didn't fulfill your obligation. That's why he says, didn't fulfill his obligation. Because the obligation is fulfilled only when you have the total picture. And the total picture is learning is very important. The person must learn, it's essential. Then telling the children exactly what happened, even the simple story must be told. But then you must show them how these mitzvahs, why do I do the mitzvah? Now we come to, what does the mitzvah have to do with this whole business over here? If you don't explain that, again you don't fulfill. So really there's telling through the mitzvahs, telling through explaining the mitzvahs. Alright? One is telling through learning, and the other one is telling through explaining the mitzvahs. Now let's take a look. How do you explain the mitzvahs through the telling? What is it? It says, the Passover offering which our fathers ate in the temple days, what was the reason for it? It was because the Holy One, blessed be He, passed over the houses of our forefathers in Egypt, as it is written in the Bible. Okay? We'll take matzah. What is matzah? This matzah that we eat, what is the reason for it? It's because there was not enough time for the dough of our ancestors in Egypt to become leavened before the ruler of all, the Holy One, blessed be He, revealed Himself to them and redeemed them. That's matzah. That's enough. Morah, the bitter herbs which you eat, what is the meaning of the bitter herbs? They are eaten to recall that the Egyptians embittered the lives of our forefathers in Egypt, as it is written, and they embittered their lives with hard labor, with mortar and bricks, with every kind of work in the fields. All the work which they made them do was rigorous. So these three mitzvahs of Pesach, Matzah, and Morah are really tied into the concept of the redemption, and you have to explain that. Now I'd like to just understand, why are there three mitzvahs? Let's go a little bit into the philosophy of the why. Now we went through a lot of the what. Let's understand, why do you think there are three mitzvahs? It could have been 10, could have been 6, could have been 1, 2. Why these? If the Torah gives you three, if God told us that there are three, the Passover lamb, there's the matzah, there's the mar, it must make sense. So what do the three really, why the three? There's apparently three elements here in the going out of Egypt. And these three are expressed in these mitzvahs. What are the three elements that would put together? See, these mitzvahs have to put together the Seder, the whole essence of the Seder.
Okay.
Unless somebody has any suggestion? Really, there's three factors that you have to know. First of all, the first fact you have to know is the state of the Jews before they were redeemed. Right? Then you must know the state of the Jews after they were redeemed, right? And then there's one more thing you must know. What's the last thing you must know? Who and how it was brought about? How it was executed? How it was brought into being? See? Now, Morah really is what? Morah is? It's the hardship before. And the matzah was when they left Egypt. The matzah was after the state, right? That was what they ate on the way out. So the matzah represents the change of state. The morah to the matzah is two different changes of state. Morah is the bitter life, and the matzah is the free life that they had after they left Egypt. And the third important thing that we must never forget is who was responsible for the going out and how it was done. That is the Pesach, or the Passover, when God passed over the houses of the Jews in Egypt, and the Jews were able to be saved at that point. That was how it was done by God. That's Pesach. So Pesach is really who did it? God. And how was it done? Through the mitzvah, through this mitzvah of the Korban Pesach. So it's who and how, that's the relationship to God, and then the two different states. The state before, which is the Morah, and the state after, which is the Matzah. Basically, those three mitzvahs, that's why there are three mitzvahs. Because those three mitzvahs briefly tie up the whole concept of the going out of Egypt. Okay. Briefly, so that we have an overall picture of Haggadah, which is really an important thing. You have the Kiddush, defining what the day is, right? And then you define the day with showing that it's different from any other day. It's a holiday. It's a holiday not just like any other holiday, but it's different than any other night, because it has specific mitzvahs. You enunciate the mitzvahs in the Manishtana. Whether they're questions or whether they're statements, that's an argument among the rabbis. You could choose your own decision on that. Either way, you won't be going wrong. Then after that, you have all the laws of how to tell the son, how to tell the four sons, the area of four sons, how to tell them what. And then You have the learning process, the Tzeilamad, common learn from the Torah, which is another way of telling. And the third way of telling is through explaining the mitzvos. You can't just tell in the abstract, but you must also show it in the practical through the mitzvos. That's the third part. That really summarizes basically the Haggadah, what the Haggadah is. And if we want, we can go a little further. It's up to you. Again, Tzeilamad, common learn. Without the oral law, you would never, you can't know it from the Bible itself. That's why the oral law goes hand in hand.
I couldn't find it,
right. The answer is like this. The Medrash explains that what happened was, first of all, it was done very subtly by Pharaoh and very slow.
Subtly
and slowly. Slowly it was done. What happened was that the Jews started to become a part of Egyptian society. And the Medrash says that when they would have their different events of the day, whatever sports or whatever events that they had, they used to entertain themselves with, they would look in the stadiums and they'd see the Jews. And the Jews were becoming very prominent and very well known, and they started, this anti-Semitism started to begin. And they started to have this fear and this hatred that these people, just like it happened within our time in Germany and some of the other places, that the Jews became part of the society. And once they became part of society, a tremendous amount of hatred started to be expressed towards them. And Pharaoh was real, when he started the anti-Semitic program, it was a very slow process. He didn't just come out there. The Bible puts it in briefly, but the process took many years. As a matter of fact, the Medrash says that when he first started the working, when he started to work, he said, well, let's build these treasure cities. And he himself went down to work the first day. He went down to work, and the Egyptians went down to work. Everybody was working. Then slowly he started to pull out certain people, his own people, the Egyptians, until eventually, after many years, the only ones that were left were the Jews. So it wasn't done suddenly, but it was done with political acumen, very subtly and very intelligently, until eventually he had the Jews where he wanted them. But the interesting thing is that it's funny, when we look back at these civilizations, we always think, well, ancient, primitive, you know. The truth of the matter is that they were just as intelligent in terms of politics as we are today. I mean, whether a person uses a car or a buggy doesn't really make a difference in how you're going to react. In terms of world history, if you look into world history, and I think Thor Heyerdahl one time mentioned this, he's a person that studies ancient civilizations, and he says that when you study these civilizations, you find that they're just as intelligent as we are today, and they basically have the same type of life. Whether a person uses a primitive car or an automobile doesn't make any difference. And they were intelligent, and they knew how to enslave a nation in a way that they can get away with it. Because if Pharaoh would come one day and say, Jews are going to be enslaved, the Egyptians would have fought him. They would say, hey, that's not fair. He's going crazy. Maybe he's going to do something to us also. We can't trust the man. It was done subtly and slowly. First, everybody went down to work. Then he started to withdraw certain top people. Oh, top people are excused from labor.
Well, this wasn't the same thing.
That's a question. There is an argument we do not know. Whether it was, when it says that there was a new king in Egypt, some say it was actually a new king, and some say that it was the same.
And the time of that pharaoh, there were
kings. That's right.
We know
there were several generations in Egypt when they were multiplying, correct. See? And during the time they were multiplying, that's when the fear of numbers and the prominence, the Jews were becoming very prominent. They were sitting in the stadiums and well-dressed and well-respected people, and they had this fear that they were going to be overtaken. If you take a look, you'll see that, I'm sorry, there's so many points here that it's not enough really to accomplish it in one time. But this one thing I will mention, if you take a look at page 11, line 8, he keeps his promise to Israel. Blessed be he, for God foretold the end of the bondage to Abraham at the covenant of sacrifices. For God said to Abraham, know you that your children will be strangers in the land not their own. They will be enslaved there and will be oppressed 400 years. The nation who will oppress them shall, however, be judged. Afterward, they will come forth with great wealth. So that, you see, if you take a look at the, that's what you mentioned, that it was predestined. In the time of Abraham, God already foretold Abraham that the Jews are going to be in Egypt. So the question is why? I mean, why should we be predestined? What's the purpose of this? So we mentioned as follows that the reason is God's purpose ultimately was to create a Jewish nation. And it was necessary that certain things take place in order to have a Jewish nation. Because what happened was, before you had the nation, before you had a Jewish nation, it was really, before the Torah was given actually, it was more or less an individual basis. Abraham was an individual, and then you see his son, Ishmael, from the Arabs descend. It was different, he wasn't Jewish. Esau was the Romans, and different, it was an individual basis. One that stayed with the religion was fine, the person didn't. It was his choice. He could do whatever he wanted. But God felt that in order for the world to exist later, in the future years, it's necessary to have one nation that lives by the code. In order that any other nation, any other person that's searching for something has some place to go. Where does a person go? He wants to find out something about a religion. So God felt we have to have one nation that keeps the law so that the whole world has access to this. And the Jewish nation was chosen, as you know, with this obligation. Now, the point is that God realized that it would be impossible to just take this nation and just say like this, okay, you are the ones that are going to accept the Torah. It wouldn't work. They had to go through the process of slavery. Why did they have to go through the process of slavery? The reason is because if a person is living in a materialistic society and he is involved in the materialism, like the Jews were in Egypt, they were prominent, successful individuals among the Egyptians, he's not going to accept the Torah so quickly. I mean, he has a lot going for him there. And he's not going to give it up so easily. He's not giving up his high position and his high office, you know, and his luxuries. And if you read through, if you study Egyptian life, it's very interesting. Their luxuries were, that was the center of luxury, the way they lived. Palaces, because they had the Nile. The Nile would flow. It was a natural thing. As a matter of fact, the Nile was a river which you can navigate up and down the river without using any machine or any strength. You know why? Because they go downstream one way and the wind blew the other way. So they put the sail up and go the other way. So they always had transportation. It was amazing land. If you look through and you study the geography and the history of Egypt, you'll see the way they lived. As a matter of fact, they had the water coming in, and they even had bathrooms and showers. And it's amazing. They had plumbing because of the way the land was worked out. So this was the center of materialism in the world. And Jews who were involved in that scene weren't going to give it up so quickly, God knew, without just for no reason at all. Now, once they were in slavery and they had nothing, everything was taken away from them, then they were in a low level of materialism. Then when Moses came and spoke to them, they were willing to listen. That maybe there's another way, besides materialism, maybe there's another life that is free and that is valuable, that doesn't involve materialism. But that's why they had to go through the process of slavery. That's why it was predestined. Because if it wasn't for slavery, there wouldn't be any nation. It had to be that way. Otherwise, they would never accept it.
What was it?
You mean until the reduction done? That's a very good question. Those years are really essentially are hidden from us as to what exactly and how Moses felt towards the Jews. We do not know too much about it. We only know that during that time, apparently, what it would seem that during that time, from the Medrash, he was involved, since he was a prince in the house of Pharaoh, he was free to do whatever he wanted to. And essentially what he did was, he involved himself in philosophical speculation. And he was in elite quest, involving himself in study, so that he had reached a certain level of knowledge during that time. And before he went out to the Jews, he had already achieved a certain level of knowledge. That's why he was capable of having God relate to him. But before, he didn't do any actions during that time. It would appear there was a period of study in which he was involved in. He was involved himself personally as a free man. He was able to do anything he wanted, and he chose to involve himself in the area of thought. And he involved himself in the intellectual area, not in the practical, in the intellectual area for many, many years, until at one time he felt that now is the time to practically apply the knowledge that he had gained. And at that point he had God communicated with him. When he started to really involve himself. See, before it seems he was removed from the practical. Then after years of involvement in abstract thought, he started to get involved in political thought. What is going on here? And he started to take a look at the way the people are enslaved and questions of justice and injustice. And once he moved in that direction, you see, then that really was the step that actually made him capable, made him fit to be the leader. This type of class is one which, even for fellows in the yeshiva, you know, you have to really listen carefully to every step in the formulation. And it's not like something you're used to, or a simple philosophy. And I hope it wasn't too tedious for you to go through. But I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it very much.
Rabbi?
Yes. One thing I'd like to mention about the Afikoman, how do you mention it? The Afikoman is something that I think is very misunderstood, because we always say, well, you have to eat the matzah at the end of the meal, and then you're not supposed to lose the taste of the matzah. Now you can drink wine. You drink wine after the Atikama, so you don't have the taste anymore. And you can drink as much water as you want. The taste over there doesn't mean the physical taste. The idea of the Afikoman is that this meal on Passover is a meal which is supposed to be on the highest level of human performance. And the highest level of human performance is where a meal isn't eaten just to satiate the belly, but the meal is eaten for the purpose of being able to perform mitzvahs and being able to do the right thing. And the meal has to be one which is a conceptual meal, a meal which is on the highest level. Now, the highest level is represented by the fact that you eat the matzah, which is an object of mitzvah, at the culmination, the end of the meal. Now, when it says the taste of the matzah is in your mouth, it really means that the idea of the mitzvah remains with you from this meal. Not to walk away from the meal and say, well, it felt very good. But the good feeling should come not only from the food, which, of course, a person should feel good from food also, but the essential thing is not the food that one eats, but the mitzvah they fulfilled. So that when the last thing you do with the meal is to eat matzah, which is the mitzvah, so that the taste of that mitzvah should remain with you. And you should remember as the culmination of the meal is the mitzvah. That's really the purpose of the Atikama.